I drove to the gate of the parking lot and looked right to check for traffic. When I did, I saw John looking at me thoughtfully. What? Maddie said you were writing, that's all. Book go tits up on you or something? My childhood friend was just as lively as ever, in fact, but it would never be finished. I knew that this morning, as well as I knew there was rain on the way. The boys in the basement had for some reason decided to take it back. Asking why might not be such a good idea. The answers might be unpleasant. Something. I'm not sure just what. I pulled out onto the highway, checked behind me, and saw Rami and George following in George's little Altima. America has become a country full of big men in little cars. What do you want me to listen to? If it's home karaoke, I pass. The last thing on earth I want to hear is you singing Bubba Shot the Jukebox last night. Oh, it's better than that, he said, miles better. He opened his briefcase, rooted through it, and came out with a plastic cassette box. The tape inside was marked 7/20/98, yesterday. I love this, he said. He leaned forward, turned on the radio, then popped the cassette into the player. I was hoping I'd already had my quota of nasty surprises for the morning, but I was wrong. Sorry, I just had to get rid of another call, John said from my Chevy speakers, in his smoothest, most lawyerly voice. I'd have bet $1 million that his bony shins hadn't been showing when this tape was made. There was a laugh, both smoky and grating. My stomach seized up at the sound of it. I remembered seeing her for the first time standing outside the Sunset Bar, wearing black shorts over a black tank-style swimsuit, standing there and looking like a refugee from crash diet hell. You mean you had to turn on your tape recorder, she said. And now I remembered how the water had seemed to change color when she nailed me that really good one in the back of the head. From bright orange to dark scarlet, it had gone. And then I'd started drinking the lake. That's okay. Tape anything you want. John reached out suddenly and ejected the cassette. You don't need to hear this, he said. It's not substantive. I thought you'd get a kick out of her blather, but, man, you look terrible. Do you want me to drive? You're white as a fucking sheet. I can drive, I said. Go on, play it. Afterward, I'll tell you about a little adventure I had Friday night, but you're going to keep it to yourself. They don't have to know. I jerked my thumb over my shoulder at the Altima, and Maddie doesn't have to know, especially Maddie. He reached for the tape, then hesitated. You're sure? Yeah, it was just hearing her again out of the blue like that. The quality of her voice. Christ, the reproduction is good. Nothing but the best for Avery, McLean, and Bernstein. We have very strict protocols about what we can tape, by the way, if you were wondering. I wasn't. I imagine none of it's admissible in litigation anyway, is it? In certain rare cases, a judge might let a tape in, but that's not why we do it. A tape like this saved a man's life 4 years ago, right around the time I joined the firm. That guy is now in the witness protection program. Play it. He leaned forward and pushed the button. John. How is the desert, Ms. Whitmore? Whitmore. Hot. John. Arrangements progressing nicely? I know how difficult times like this can... Whitmore. You know very little, Counselor. Take it from me. Can we cut the crap? John. Consider it cut. Whitmore. Have you conveyed the conditions of Mr. DeVore's will to his daughter-in-law? John. Yes, ma'am. Whitmore. Her response? John. I have none to give you now. I may have after Mr. DeVore's will has been probated. But surely you know such codicils are rarely, if ever, accepted by the courts. Whitmore. Well, if that little lady moves out of town, we'll see, won't we? John. I suppose we will. Whitmore. When is the victory party? John. Excuse me? Whitmore. Oh, please. I have 60 different appointments today, plus a boss to bury tomorrow. You're going up there to celebrate with her and her daughter, aren't you? Did you know she's invited the writer, her fuck buddy? John turned to me gleefully. Do you hear how pissed she sounds? She's trying to hide it, but she can't. It's eating her up inside. I barely heard him. I was in the zone with what she was saying. The writer, her fuck buddy. And what was under what she was saying. Some quality beneath the words. "We just want to see how long you can swim," she had called out to me. "John, I hardly think what I or Maddie's friends do is any of your business, Ms. Whitmore. May I respectfully suggest that you party with your friends and let Maddie DeVore party with her..." Whitmore, give him a message. Me. She was talking about me. Then I realized it was even more personal than that. She was talking to me. Her body might be on the other side of the country, but her voice and spiteful spirit were right here in the car with us. And Max DeVore's will, not the meaningless shit his lawyers had put down on paper, but his will. The old bastard was as dead as Damocles, but yes, he was definitely still seeking custody. "John, give who a message, Ms. Whitmore?" Whitmore, tell him he never answered Mr. DeVore's question. "John, what question is that?" "Does her cunt suck?" Whitmore, ask him. He'll know. "John, if you mean Mike Noonan, you can ask him yourself. You'll see him in Castle County Probate Court this fall." Whitmore, I hardly think so. Mr. DeVore's will was made and witnessed out here. "John, nevertheless, it will be probated in Maine, where he died. My heart is set on it. And when you leave Castle County the next time, Roguette, you will do so with your education in matters of the law considerably broadened." For the first time, she sounded angry, her voice rising to a reedy caw. Whitmore, if you think... John, I don't think. I know. Goodbye, Ms. Whitmore. Whitmore, you might do well to stay away from... There was a click, the hum of an open line, then a robot voice saying, 9:40 a.m., Eastern Daylight, July 20th. John punched eject, collected his tape, and stored it back in his briefcase. I hung up on her. He sounded like a man telling you about his first skydive. I actually did. She was mad, wasn't she? Wouldn't you say she was seriously pissed? Yeah. It was what he wanted to hear, but not what I really believed. Pissed, yes. Seriously pissed? Maybe not. Because Maddie's location and state of mind hadn't been her concern. Roguette had called to talk to me. To tell me she was thinking of me. To bring back memories of how it felt to tread water with the back of your head gushing blood. To freak me out. And she had succeeded. What was the question you didn't answer? John asked me. I don't know what she meant by that, I said, but I can tell you why hearing her turned me a little white in the gills, if you can be discreet, and if you want to hear. We've got 18 miles to cover. Lay it on me. I told him about Friday night. I didn't clutter up my version with visions or psychic phenomena. There was just Michael Noonan out for a sunset walk along the street. I'd been standing by a birch tree which hung over the lake, watching the sun drop toward the mountains when they came up behind me. From the point where DeVore charged me with his wheelchair to the point where I finally got back onto solid ground, I stuck pretty much to the truth. When I finished, John was at first utterly silent. It was a measure of how thrown for a loop he was. Under normal circumstances, he was every bit the chatterbox Kai was. Well, I asked, comments? Questions? Lift your hair so I can see behind your ear. I did as he asked, revealing a big band-aid and a large area of swelling. John leaned forward to study it, like a little kid observing his best friend's battle scar during recess. Holy shit, he said at last. It was my turn to say nothing. Those two old fucks tried to drown you. I said nothing. They tried to drown you for helping Maddie. Now I really said nothing. And you never reported it? I started to, I said, then realized I'd make myself look like a whiny little asshole, and a liar, most likely. How much do you think Osgood might know? About them trying to drown me? Nothing. He's just a messenger boy. A little more of that unusual quiet from John. After a few seconds of it, he reached out and touched the lump on the back of my head. Ow! Sorry. A pause. Jesus. Then he went back to Warrington's and pulled the fucking pin. Jesus. Michael, I never would have played that tape if I'd known. It's all right. But don't even think of telling Maddie. I'm wearing my hair over my ear like that for a reason. Will you ever tell her, do you think? I might. Someday when he's been dead long enough so we can laugh about me swimming with my clothes on. That might be a while, he said. Yeah, it might. We drove in silence for a bit. I could sense John groping for a way to bring the day back to jubilation and loved him for it. He leaned forward, turned on the radio, and found something loud and nasty by Guns N' Roses. Welcome to the jungle, baby. We got fun and games. Party till we puke, he said. Right? I grinned. It wasn't easy with the sound of the old woman's voice still clinging to me like light slime, but I managed. If you insist, I said. I do, he said, most certainly. John, you're a good guy for a lawyer, and you're a good one for a writer. This time the grin on my face felt more natural and stayed on longer. We passed the marker reading TR-90, and as we did, the sun burned through the haze and flooded the day with light. It seemed like an omen of better times ahead until I looked into the west. There, black in the bright, I could see the thunderheads building up over the White Mountains. For men, I think love is a thing formed of equal parts lust and astonishment. The astonishment part women understand. The lust part they only think they understand. Very few, perhaps 1 in 20, have any concept of what it really is or how deep it runs. That's probably just as well for their sleep and peace of mind. And I'm not talking about the lust of satyrs and rapists and molesters. I'm talking about the lust of shoe clerks and high school principals. Not to mention writers and lawyers. We turned into Maddie's dooryard at 10 to 11, and as I parked my Chevy beside her rusted-out Jeep, the trailer door opened, and Maddie came out on the top step. I sucked in my breath, and beside me I could hear John sucking in his. She was very likely the most beautiful young woman I have ever seen in my life, as she stood there in her rose-colored shorts and matching midi top. The shorts were not short enough to be cheap, my mother's word, but plenty short enough to be provocative. Her top tied in floppy string bows across the shoulders and showed just enough tan to dream on. Her hair hung to her shoulders. She was smiling and waving. I thought, she's made it. Take her into the country club dining room now, dressed just as she is, and she shuts everyone else down. Oh, Lordy, John said. There was a kind of dismayed longing in his voice. All that and a bag of chips. Yeah, I said. Put your eyes back in your head, big boy. He made cupping motions with his hands as if doing just that. George, meanwhile, had pulled his Altima in next to us. Come on, I said, opening my door. Time to party. I can't touch her, Mike, John said. I'll melt. Come on, you goof. Maddie came down the steps and passed the pot with the tomato plant in it. Kai was behind her, dressed in an outfit similar to her mother's, only in a shade of dark green. She had the shies again, I saw. She kept one steadying hand on Maddie's leg and one thumb in her mouth. The guys are here! The guys are here! Maddie cried, laughing, and threw herself into my arms. She hugged me tight and kissed the corner of my mouth. I hugged her back and kissed her cheek. Then she moved on to John, read his shirt, patted her hands together in applause, and then hugged him. He hugged back pretty well for a guy who was afraid he might melt, I thought, picking her up off her feet and swinging her around in a circle while she hung onto his neck and laughed. Rich lady, rich lady, rich lady! John chanted, then set her down on the cork soles of her white shoes. "Free lady, free lady, free lady," she chanted back. "The hell with Rich." Before he could reply, she kissed him firmly on the mouth. His arms rose to slip around her, but she stepped back before they could catch hold. She turned to Rami and George, who were standing side by side and looking like fellows who might want to explain all about the Mormon Church. I took a step forward, meaning to do the introductions, but John was taking care of that, and one of his arms managed to accomplish its mission after all. It circled her waist as he led her forward toward the men. Meanwhile, a little hand slipped into mine. I looked down and saw Kai looking up at me. Her face was grave and pale, and every bit as beautiful as her mother's. Her blonde hair, freshly washed and shining, was held back with a velvet scrunchie. "Guess the Frigifator people don't like me now," she said. The laughter and insouciance were gone, at least for the moment. She looked on the verge of tears. "My letters all went bye-bye." I picked her up and set her in the crook of my arm as I had on the day I'd met her walking down the middle of Route 68 in her bathing suit. I kissed her forehead and then the tip of her nose. Her skin was perfect silk. "I know they did," I said. "I'll buy you some more." "Promise?" Doubtful dark blue eyes fixed on mine. "Promise, and I'll teach you special words like zygote and bibulus. I know lots of special words."
"How many?"
180. Thunder rumbled in the west. It didn't seem louder, but it was more focused somehow. Kai's eyes went in that direction, then came back to mine. "I'm scared, Mike."
"Scared? Of what?"
"Of I don't know. The lady in Maddie's dress. Of the men we saw." Then she looked over my shoulder. "Here comes Mommy." I have heard actresses deliver the line, "not in front of the children," in that exact same tone of voice. Kyra wiggled in the circle of my arms.
"Land me."
I landed her. Maddie, John, Rami, and George Kennedy came over to join us. Kai ran to Maddie, who picked her up and then surveyed us like a general surveying her troops.
"Got the beer?" she asked me.
"Yes'm, a case of Bud and a dozen mixed sodas as well, plus lemonade."
"Great. Mr. Kennedy?"
"George, ma'am."
"George, then. And if you call me ma'am again, I'll punch you in the nose. I'm Maddie. Would you drive down to the Lakeview General?"
She pointed to the store on Route 68, about half a mile from us. "And get some ice?"
"You bet."
"Mr. Bissonette."
"Rami."
"There's a little garden at the north end of the trailer, Rami. Can you find a couple of good-looking lettuces?"
"I think I can handle that."
"John, let's get the meat into the fridge. As for you, Michael," she pointed to the barbecue, "the briquettes are the self-lighting kind. Just drop a match and stand back."
"Do your duty."
"Aye, good lady," I said, and dropped to my knees in front of her. That finally got a giggle out of Kai.
Laughing, Maddie took my hand and pulled me back onto my feet.
"Come on, Sir Galahad," she said. "It's going to rain. I want to be safe inside and too stuffed to jump when it does."
In the city, parties begin with greetings at the door, gathered in coats, and those peculiar little air kisses. When exactly did that social oddity begin? In the country, they begin with chores. You fetch, you carry, you hunt for stuff like barbecue tongs and oven mitts. The hostess drafts a couple of men to move the picnic table, then decides it was actually better where it was and asks them to put it back. And at some point, you discover that you're having fun. I piled briquettes until they looked approximately like the pyramid on the bag, then touched a match to them. They blazed up satisfyingly, and I stood back, wiping my forearm across my forehead. Cool and clear might be coming, but it surely wasn't in hailing distance yet. The sun had burned through, and the day had gone from dull to dazzling. Yet in the west, black satin thunderheads continued to stack up. It was as if night had burst a blood vessel in the sky over there.
"Mike?"
I looked around at Kyra.
"What, honey?"
"Will you take care of me?"
"Yes,"
I said, with no hesitation at all. For a moment, something about my response, perhaps only the quickness of it, seemed to trouble her. Then she smiled.
"Okay," she said. Look, here comes the Iceman.
George was back from the store. He parked and got out. I walked over with Kyra, her holding my hand and swinging it possessively back and forth. Rami came with us, juggling three heads of lettuce. I don't think he was much of a threat to the guy who had fascinated Kai on the common Saturday night. George opened the Altima's back door and brought out two bags of ice.
The store was closed, he said. Sign said, "We'll reopen at 5 p.m. That seemed a little too long to wait, so I took the ice and put the money through the mail slot.
They'd closed for Royce Merrill's funeral, of course. Had given up almost a full day's custom at the height of the tourist season to see the old fellow into the ground. It was sort of touching. I thought it was also sort of creepy.
Can I carry some ice? Kyra asked.
I guess, but don't frizzicate yourself, George said, and carefully put a 5-pound bag of ice into Kai's outstretched arms.
Frizzicate, Kyra said, giggling.
She began walking toward the trailer where Maddie was just coming out. John was behind her and regarding her with the eyes of a gutshot beagle.
Mommy, look, I'm frizzicating.
I took the other bag. I know the icebox is outside, but don't they keep a padlock on it?
I am friends with most padlocks, George said.
Oh, I see.
Mike, catch!
John tossed a red frisbee. It floated toward me, but high. I jumped for it, snagged it, and suddenly DeVore was back in my head.
What's wrong with you, Roguette? You never used to throw like a girl. Get him!
I looked down and saw Kai looking up.
Don't think about sad stuff, she said.
I smiled at her, then flipped her the frisbee.
Okay, no sad stuff. Go on, sweetheart. Toss it to your mom. Let's see if you can.
She smiled back, turned, and made a quick, accurate flip to her mother. The toss was so hard that Maddie almost flubbed it. Whatever else Kyra DeVore might have been, she was a frisbee champion in the making. Maddie tossed the frisbee to George, who turned, the tail of his absurd brown suit coat flaring, and caught it deftly behind his back. Maddie laughed and applauded, the hem of her top flirting with her navel.
Show off, John called from the steps. Jealousy is such an ugly emotion, George said to Rami Bissonette, and flipped him the frisbee.
Rami floated it back to John, but it went wide and bonked off the side of the trailer. As John hurried down the steps to get it, Maddie turned to me.
My boombox is on the coffee table in the living room, along with a stack of CDs. Most of them are pretty old, but at least it's music. Will you bring them out?
Sure.
I went inside, where it was hot in spite of three strategically placed fans working overtime. I looked at the grim, mass-produced furniture and at Maddie's rather noble effort to impart some character. The Van Gogh print that should not have looked at home in a trailer kitchenette but did, Edward Hopper's Nighthawks over the sofa, the tie-dyed curtains that would have made Joe laugh. There was a bravery here that made me feel sad for her and furious at Max DeVore all over again. Dead or not, I wanted to kick his ass. I went into the living room and saw the new Mary Higgins Clark on the sofa end table with a bookmark sticking out of it. Lying beside it in a heap were a couple of little girl hair ribbons. Something about them looked familiar to me, although I couldn't remember ever having seen Kai wearing them. I stood there a moment longer, frowning, then grabbed the boombox and CDs and went back outside.
Hey, guys, I said, let's rock.
I was okay until she danced. I don't know if it matters to you, but it does to me. I was okay until she danced. After that, I was lost. We took the frisbee around to the rear of the house, partly so we wouldn't piss off any funeral-bound townies with our rowdiness and good cheer, mostly because Maddie's backyard was a good place to play, level ground and low grass. After a couple of missed catches, Maddie kicked off her party shoes, dashed barefoot into the house, and came back in her sneakers. After that, she was a lot better. We threw the frisbee, yelled insults at each other, drank beer, laughed a lot. Kai wasn't much on the catching part, but she had a phenomenal arm for a kid not quite four and played with gusto. Rami had set the boombox up on the trailer's back step
and it spun out a haze of late 80s and early 90s music. U2, Tears for Fears, The Eurythmics, Crowded House, A Flock of Seagulls, Aha, The Bangles, Melissa Etheridge, Huey Lewis and the News. It seemed to me that I knew every song, every riff. We sweated and sprinted in the noon light. We watched Maddie's long, tan legs flash and listened to the bright runs of Kyra's laughter. At one point, Rami Bissonette went head over heels, all the change spilling out of his pockets, and John laughed until he had to sit down. Tears rolled from his eyes. Kai ran over and plopped on his defenseless lap. John stopped laughing in a hurry. "Oof!" he cried, looking at me with shining, wounded eyes, as his bruised balls no doubt tried to climb back inside his body. "Kyra DeVore!" Maddie cried, looking at John apprehensively. "I tackled my own quarterback," Kai said proudly. John smiled feebly at her and staggered to his feet. "Yes," he said, "you did, and the ref calls 15 yards for squashing." "Are you okay, man?" George asked. He looked concerned, but his voice was grinning. "I'm fine," John said, and spun him the frisbee. It wobbled feebly across the yard. "Go on, throw. Let's see what you got." The thunder rumbled louder, but the black clouds were all still west of us. The sky overhead remained a harmless, humid blue. Birds still sang, and crickets hummed in the grass. There was a heat shimmer over the barbecue, and it would soon be time to slap on John's New York steaks. The frisbee still flew, red against the green of the grass and trees, the blue of the sky. I was still in lust, but everything was still all right. Men are in lust all over the world and damn near all of the time, and the ice caps don't melt. But she danced, and everything changed. It was an old Don Henley song, one driven by a really nasty guitar riff. "Oh, God, I love this one," Maddie cried. The frisbee came to her. She caught it, dropped it, stepped on it as if it were a hot red spot falling on a nightclub stage, and began to shake. She put her hands first behind her neck, and then on her hips, and then behind her back. She danced standing with the toes of her sneakers on the frisbee. She danced without moving. She danced, as they say in that song, like a wave on the ocean. The government bugged the men's room in the local disco lounge, and all she wants to do is dance, dance, to keep the boys from selling all the weapons they can scrounge. And all she wants to do, all she wants to do is dance. Women are sexy when they dance, incredibly sexy, but that wasn't what I reacted to, or how I reacted. The lust I was coping with, but this was more than lust and not copable. It was something that sucked the wind out of me and left me feeling utterly at her mercy. In that moment, she was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. Not a pretty woman in shorts and a midi top dancing in place on a frisbee, but Venus revealed. She was everything I had missed during the last 4 years, when I'd been so badly off I didn't know I was missing anything. She robbed me of any last defenses I might have had. The age difference didn't matter. If I looked to people like my tongue was hanging out even when my mouth was shut, then so be it. If I lost my dignity, my pride, my sense of self, then so be it. 4 years on my own had taught me there are worse things to lose. How long did she stand there dancing? I don't know. Probably not long, not even a minute. And then she realized we were looking at her, rapt, because to some degree they all saw what I saw and felt what I felt. For that minute, or however long it was, I don't think any of us used much oxygen. She stepped off the frisbee, laughing and blushing at the same time, confused but not really uncomfortable. "I'm sorry," she said. I love that song." "All she wants to do is dance," Rami said. "Yes, sometimes that's all she wants," Maddie said, and blushed harder than ever. "Excuse me, I have to use the facility." She tossed me the frisbee and then dashed for the trailer. I took a deep breath, trying to steady myself back to reality, and saw John doing the same thing. George Kennedy was wearing a mildly stunned expression, as if someone had fed him a light sedative, and it was finally taking effect. Thunder rumbled, This time it did sound closer. I skimmed the frisbee to Rami. "What do you think?" "I think I'm in love," he said, and then seemed to give himself a small mental shake. It was a thing you could see in his eyes. "I also think it's time we got going on those steaks if we're going to eat outside. Want to help me?"
"Sure."
"I will too," John said. We walked back to the trailer, leaving George and Kyra to play toss. Kyra was asking George if he had ever caught any crinimals. In the kitchen, Maddie was standing beside the open fridge and stacking steaks on a platter. "Thank God you guys came in. I was on the point of giving in and gobbling one of these things just the way it is. They're the most beautiful things I ever saw."
"You're the most beautiful thing I ever saw," John said.
He was being totally sincere, but the smile she gave him was distracted and a little bemused. I made a mental note to myself. Never compliment a woman on her beauty when she has a couple of raw steaks in her hands. It just doesn't turn the windmill somehow. "How are you at barbecuing meat?" she asked me. "Tell the truth, because these are way too good to mess up."
"I can hold my own."
"Okay, you're hired. John, you're assisting. Rami, help me do salads."
"My pleasure."
George and Kai had come around to the front of the trailer and were now sitting in lawn chairs like a couple of old cronies at their London club. George was telling Kai how he had shot it out with Rolf Netto and the Real Bad Gang on Lisbon Street in 1993.
"George, what's happening to your nose?" John asked. "It's getting so long."
"Do you mind?" George asked. "I'm having a conversation here."
"Mr. Kennedy has caught lots of crooked criminals," Kyra said. "He caught the Real Bad Gang and put them in Supermax."
"Yes," I said. "Mr. Kennedy also won an Academy Award for acting in a movie called Cool Hand Luke."
"That's absolutely correct," George said. He raised his right hand and crossed the two fingers. "Me and Paul Newman, just like that."
"We have his Pischetti sauce," Kai said gravely, and that got John laughing again. It didn't hit me the same way, but laughter is catching. Just watching John was enough to break me up after a few seconds. We were howling like a couple of fools as we slapped the steaks on the grill. It's a wonder we didn't burn our hands off.
"Why are they laughing?" Kai asked George.
"Because they're foolish men with little tiny brains," George said. "Now listen, Kai. I got them all except for the human head case. He jumped into his car and I jumped into mine. The details of that chase are nothing for a little girl to hear." George regaled her with them anyway, while John and I stood grinning at each other across Maddie's barbecue.
"This is great, isn't it?" John said, and I nodded.
Maddie came out with corn wrapped in aluminum foil, followed by Rami, who had a large salad bowl clasped in his arms and negotiated the steps carefully, trying to peer over the top of the bowl as he made his way down them. We sat at the picnic table, George and Rami on one side, John and I flanking Maddie on the other. Kai sat at the head, perched on a stack of old magazines in a lawn chair. Maddie tied a dish towel around her neck, an indignity Kai submitted to only because, A, she was wearing new clothes, and, B, a dish towel wasn't a baby bib, at least technically speaking. We ate hugely. Salad, steak, and John was right, it really was the best I'd ever had. Roasted corn on the cob, strawberry snort cake for dessert. By the time we'd gotten around to the snort cake, the Thunderheads were noticeably closer, and there was a hot, jerky breeze blowing around the yard. "Maddie, if I never eat a meal as good as this one again, I won't be surprised," Rami said. "Thanks ever so much for having me."
"Thank you," she said. There were tears standing in her eyes. She took my hand on one side and John's on the other. She squeezed both. "Thank you all. If you knew what things were like for Kai and me before this last week." She shook her head, gave John and me a final squeeze, and let go. "But that's over."
"Look at the baby," George said, amused. Kai had slumped back in her lawn chair and was looking at us with glazing eyes. Most of her hair had come out of the scrunchie and lay in clumps against her cheeks. There was a dab of whipped cream on her nose and a single yellow kernel of corn sitting in the middle of her chin.
"I threw the frisbee 6,000 times,"
Kyra said. She spoke in a distant, declamatory tone. I tired. Maddie started to get up. I put my hand on her arm. Let me? She nodded, smiling. If you want. I picked Kyra up and carried her around to the steps. Thunder rumbled again, a long, low roll that sounded like the snarl of a huge dog. I looked up at the encroaching clouds, and as I did, movement caught my eye. It was an old blue car heading west on Wasp Hill Road toward the lake. The only reason I noticed it was that it was wearing one of those stupid bumper stickers from the village cafe. Horn broken, watch for finger. I carried Kai up the steps and through the door, turning her so I wouldn't bump her head. Take care of me, she said in her sleep. There was a sadness in her voice that chilled me. It was as if she knew she was asking the impossible. Take care of me. I'm little. Mama says I'm a little guy. I'll take care of you, I said, and kissed that silky place between her eyes again. Don't worry, Kai. Go to sleep. I carried her to her room and put her on her bed. By then, she was totally conked out. I wiped the cream off her nose and picked the corn kernel off her chin. I glanced at my watch and saw it was 10 till 2. They would be gathering at Grace Baptist by now. Bill Dean was wearing a gray tie. Buddy Jellison had a hat on. He was standing behind the church with some other men who were smoking before going inside. I turned. Maddie was in the doorway. Mike, she said, come here, please. I went to her. There was no cloth between her waist and my hands this time. Her skin was warm and as silky as her daughter's. She looked up at me, her lips parted. Her hips pressed forward, and when she felt what was hard down there, she pressed harder against it. Mike, she said again. I closed my eyes. I felt like someone who has just come to the doorway of a brightly lit room full of people laughing and talking. And dancing, because sometimes that is all we want to do. I want to come in, I thought. That's what I want to do, all I want to do. Let me do what I want. Let me. I realized I was saying it aloud, whispering it rapidly into her ear as I held her with my hands going up and down her back, my fingertips ridging her spine, touching her shoulder blades, then coming around in front to cup her small breasts. Yes, she said. What we both want. Yes, that's fine. I drew back from her. Slowly, she reached up with her thumbs and wiped the wet places from under my eyes. The key. She smiled a little. You know where it is. I'll come tonight. Good. I had to clear my throat. I looked at Kyra, who was deeply asleep. I've been lonely. I don't think I knew it, but I have been. Me too, and I knew it for both of us. Kiss, please. I kissed her. I think our tongues touched, but I'm not sure. What I remember most clearly is the liveliness of her. She was like a dreidel lightly spinning in my arms. Hey, John called from outside, and we sprang apart. You guys want to give us a little help? It's going to rain. Thanks for finally making up your mind, she said to me in a low voice. She turned and hurried back up the double-wide, narrow corridor. The next time she spoke to me, I don't think she knew who she was talking to or where she was. The next time she spoke to me, she was dying. Don't wake the baby, I heard her tell John, and his response, oh, sorry, sorry. I stood where I was a moment longer, getting my breath, then slipped into the bathroom and splashed cold water on my face. I remember seeing a blue plastic whale in the bathtub as I turned to take a towel off the rack. I remember thinking that it probably blew bubbles out of its spout hole, and I even remember having a momentary glimmer of an idea, a children's story about a spouting whale. Would you call him Willie? Nah, too obvious.
Wilhelm now. That had a fine, round ring to it, simultaneously grand and amusing. Wilhelm de Spouting Veil. I remember the bang of thunder from overhead. I remember how happy I was with the decision finally made and the night to look forward to. I remember the murmur of men's voices and the murmur of Maddie's response as she told them where to put the stuff. Then I heard all of them going back out again. I looked down at myself and saw a certain lump was subsiding. I remember thinking there was nothing so absurd looking as a sexually excited man, and knew I'd had this same thought before, perhaps in a dream. I left the bathroom, checked on Kyra again, rolled over on her side, fast asleep, and then went down the hall. I had just reached the living room when gunfire erupted outside. I never confused the sound with thunder. There was a moment when my mind fumbled toward the idea of backfires, some kid's hot rod, and then I knew. Part of me had been expecting something to happen, but it had been expecting ghosts rather than gunfire, a fatal lapse. It was the rapid pa, pa, pa of an autofire weapon, a Glock 9mm as it turned out. Maddie screamed, a high, drilling scream that froze my blood. I heard John cry out in pain, and George Kennedy bellow, "Down! Down! For the love of Christ, get her down!" Something hit the trailer like a hard spatter of hail, a rattle of punching sounds running from west to east. Something split the air in front of my eyes. I heard it. There was an almost musical sproing sound, like a snapping guitar string. On the kitchen table, the salad bowl one of them had just brought in shattered. I ran for the door and nearly dived down the cement block steps. I saw the barbecue overturned with the glowing coals already setting patches of the scant front yard grass on fire. I saw Rami Bissonette sitting with his legs outstretched, looking stupidly down at his ankle, which was soaked with blood. Maddie was on her hands and knees by the barbecue with her hair hanging in her face. It was as if she meant to sweep up the hot coals before they could cause some real trouble. John staggered toward me, holding out a hand. The arm above it was soaked with blood. And I saw the car I'd seen before, the nondescript sedan with the joke sticker on it. It had gone up the road, the men inside making that first pass to check us out, then turned around and come back. The shooter was still leaning out the front passenger window. I could see the stubby smoking weapon in his hands. It had a wire stock. His features were a blue blank, broken only by huge gaping eye sockets, a ski mask. Overhead, thunder gave a long awakening roar.